Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor Industry and Veteran, Labor Industry, Veterans and Military Affairs, Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom in this committee, will please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And to the Republic for which it stands, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang.
Present.
Representative Detmer.
Detmer present.
Representative McDonald.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Sundin.
Sundin present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
And we have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle. Quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from the March 3rd, 2021 meeting. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Greenman, did you have a chance to review the minutes?
I did. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman moves approval of minutes from the March 3rd, 2021 meeting. Any comments or corrections? All in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are approved. We have members. We had one bill get pulled from the agenda. It was too late to get another one posted. Before we bring on Representative Frazier for House File 41, members, in this time of Zoom, it is imperative that we run the meeting through the chair and do not make comments without running through the chair in order to have an orderly meeting. So I just want to remind all members of that before we get going. And Representative Frazier, this isn't for the last time you were here, but it was for the committee hearing yesterday. So anyway, first bill on the agenda today is House File 41 from Representative Frazier. I will move that House File 41 be re-referred to state government finance. And Representative Frazier, we have a DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment, and would you please explain it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I am glad to finally be back. There's been a lot of conversation since then, which leads me into the conversation around this amendment. Like after our initial hearing, we did have conversations with stakeholders, many of the ones that testified. And what we decided to do was, after meeting with stakeholders that support this bill, we decided to go back and really focus in and hone in on the reason and the purpose that we brought the bill. And the reason and the purpose that we brought the bill, as I spoke to in the last hearing, was that we really wanted to make sure that we were capturing folks that were left out of the Family First Coronavirus Response Act that was passed last March. So the amendments that are here now are really to make sure that we align with that. And I'll just go through a few highlights to kind of show you where we are, and then I'll stand by for questions, Chair. So we changed the definition of essential worker. So that now includes public and private healthcare workers, public and private emergency responders, public school workers, airport service providers, and workers employed by a private business and building services, childcare, food service, hotel accommodations, manufacturing, and retail. We replaced all references to employee with essential worker to be consistent. We adjusted the benefit to 80 hours max. Before it was 100, 80 hours max is in line with the FFCRA. We adjusted the 2-week max compensation to $5,110 total benefit. We clarified the retroactivity date so that it only applied to current employees at the time of the enactment, and the effective date is the day after enactment or May 17th, 2021. And really, the reason we did that May 17th date, there are some hourly school workers that we want to make sure that we capture with this bill that were impacted by this back from last March. And then we provided a sunset date for subdivisions 1 through 5, which is 30 days that will end after the peacetime emergency. There's also another sunset provision which provides for 2 years after the end of the peacetime emergency. And the reason for that is to make sure the DLI has the ability to continue enforcing and investigating the complaints that come after the bill ends. And with that, Chair, those are the highlights that I want to point out. I will stand by for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Representative Frazier, any further explanation to share or update since the last hearing?
Chair Eklund, there are some updates around what the feds are doing, but I think those will come up during questioning, so I will address them at that point.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. We can have fiscal staff walk through the fiscal note quickly, and then we'll move to member questions. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can hear you fine, Ms.
Okay,
Roberts.
Okay, good. So the fiscal note for House File 41, two agencies assigned to the fiscal note are under the jurisdiction of this committee. The first is Department of Labor and Industry. Their discussion starts on page 15, and they were assigned to the note because they were given the authority to investigate complaints and enforcement duties. And they are showing some costs of $209,000 in fiscal year 21, but are going to absorb those costs. So that's about 1.8 FTE. And on page 18, you can see their reasoning is because the bill is temporary and the department is going to leverage existing funds available due to the hiring freeze and less travel, and then redirect existing staff. And then the second agency under this committee's jurisdiction is Veterans Affairs. They are also showing no cost. They were assigned because of the employees at the two veterans homes. And if you look in the last page of the fiscal note on page 58, their conclusion is that because the employees and residents of the homes have reached over 90% vaccination rate for COVID, and they have almost zero positives in the last 2 weeks, that they don't predict any additional state cost.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Is that all we have on the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chair, those were the only two agencies under this committee, and they're both showing no cost.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. We will go to member questions. Representative Polston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier, just a quick question. As we've been talking, I've been trying to find online here where the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce stands on your bill. Can you tell us that?
Representative Frazier.
I believe they have raised questions around the impact it would have on some small businesses, is what I last heard.
Representative Polston.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll get the hand down so I don't forget it later. Thank you, Mr. Chair, appreciate it very much. And to the bill's author, in reading the bill, do you think that this proposal require retroactive back pay? And then if it does, do you think that the employers, what mechanism are they gonna use to find the employers or employees that may fall underneath this bill? Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Riley, for that question. So the retroactivity will only be for individuals that are still employed with these employers. So I would imagine they would use their regular administrative documents and processes to ensure that their employees, that any employees that are eligible are in fact eligible for the benefit.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And have you worked with any businesses that would be affected by this? And what has been their response so far? And I'm specifically thinking about the additional burdens that are gonna be placed on them, and whether or not a business that has complied with like the FFCRA requirements would now be required to comply with a different set of requirements. Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, that is a great question. It's almost as if I gave you that question to ask me, so I appreciate it.
That's why we're working together, Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley, yeah. So I have spoke with some businesses about this, and we've addressed that particular issue there about how they could find or work with those employees that are still currently employed with them. You don't have to go to employees that are no longer employed. So it's okay. Employees that are employed with them. And if they've already abided by or had something that is more generous than the FFCRA, they don't have to worry about this. They've already taken care of those employees.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, just a comment on this one. The feeling that I'm getting from the bills, this one and the other bills that we're hearing, it feels like we're putting more and more mandates on businesses. And I'm just wondering, what is the general feeling on when will these mandates end? And at what point are we going to be put so many burdens on employers that it just becomes too onerous to continue to do business, Mr. Chair?
Representative Riley, I will try that. When a group comes into the minority or the majority, they have their priorities that we put together in the caucus, and this is one of the caucus priorities. As you can see, where House File 41 is one of the relatively low numbered bills that we've been hearing in this committee, and Representative Frazier's worked pretty hard on getting this thing through. So I would guess that I would just look at it as a caucus direction, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate that. I'm satisfied.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. And I was just remembering, when we heard this a few weeks ago, the workers, the essential workers, the nurses and healthcare workers that were left out of this essential leave, and just I think as we consider this bill, just really remembering who we're talking about, the folks who are on the front lines of this fight of taking care of folks. So I just wanted to bring that voice in, but I do have a question for you. As we think about the smaller employers, is there any federal financial assistance going to folks, to small businesses who are providing the COVID leave?
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, thank you for that question. There is a benefit from the feds for smaller employers. They are allowed a tax credit, and it's dollar for dollar. So they will essentially get the resources back that they provide if they take care of folks according to the FFCRA.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank you again, Representative Frazier. I know how hard you've been working on this and how important it is for those workers, those healthcare workers, and other first responders. So thank you. Proud to support it.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier, just curious on what your thoughts are if someone who tests positive for COVID, but then finds out that it's a false positive. Some of the PCR tests have been up to 87% false positives. So in that scenario, would that same person then qualify for this 80 hours of paid sick leave?
Sam Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for that question. And thank you for playing that reggae music, really. I appreciated that while I was waiting.
Sure.
Hey, so Representative McDonald, I think the question, if they've got to take the time off, this is my opinion, right? If they've got to take the time off and it's due to a false accurate COVID test, but it will be due to COVID quarantining because that is what's required, right? You have to quarantine and take that time off. So I would say that, yes, they would be eligible for these resources because they'd have to take that time off and they'd have to miss work and potentially they'd have to miss pay if they had to. And it would be based on on the pandemic or quarantining and for those guidelines.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Frazier. Well, in that scenario, it's 80 up to 80 hours. So let's say a member, an employee, got the false positive, which is very common, decides that, I simply don't need to take this time off and I don't want to burden our employers. Employers are going to be in the industry are, trying to come back from such a drastic year as we all are, right? Every walks of life. This does put an undue burden on them. I'm not as concerned, and many folks that I've talked to, because herd immunity, the vaccines are getting out. Things are looking positive. The other strains that are out there supposedly, you know, even Mike or Hosterholm said just, I think it was 6 weeks, that we're going to go into the most darkest 14 weeks of Minnesota history because of a new strain. Well, that's not even close to coming true, and that I don't know why we would continue to listen to him, but that's beside the point. I wanted to get that in there because an employee should go back to work and help that employer retain some kind of a stability and financial.
He's got to take time off.
Hardship. What do you think about that?
Representative Frederick. Oh, Representative, there you go.
Great. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier, I apologize.
No, it's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
McDonald, could you say the last part again? I heard something, a voice over while you were speaking, and I didn't catch the last part.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I did hear that as well. An employer or employee would be able to go back to work and then not necessary would have to be have that employer pay that 80 hours. Wouldn't that be the best case scenario for both the employee and the employer and our economy? And would your bill allow for that?
Are you saying, sorry.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies. Representative McDonald, are you asking that if an employee is allowed to go back to work, then would the employer have to pay for the time of quarantine? Is that what you're asking?
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it did sound like I asked it that way, though. So you are correcting me. I guess my point was, Representative Frazier, that it is another burdensome on our businesses. We certainly want to take care of the front end workers and the essential workers. I get that. I just think that with as many false positives that we get, it could lead to an undue burdens on our businesses financially. And I guess I wanted to make that comment because certainly an employee can go back to work and not have to quarantine if he's a false positive. Wouldn't that be the case?
Representative Frazier.
Chair Eklund, thank you. Representative McDonald. Yeah, so if I got it right now, and I think I do, yeah, if the employee if they're quarantined, but then they have a false positive and they're going right back to work, then I think they're fine. They're going back to work because the employer doesn't have to pay for them not to quarantine if they've gotten a false positive and they're allowed to go back to work for guidelines. So I think in that situation, things would be fine because the employee would get to go back to work. It wouldn't be out for an entire, you know, 10 or 14 days, and they'd be back to work quicker, earlier than what the initial guidelines would say because of the false positive. But what I will say, if they have to take the time off to quarantine and they have to lose that income, then I believe that we are taking care of the worker. And like I said, for the smaller businesses, they would have the government benefit, they would have the federal benefit of getting those resources back if they paid those employees out based on the FFCRA.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just lastly, Representative Frazier, everyone in the legislature, all us legislators have talked to our constituents, have been businesses and families. We all know that people have contracted the COVID and have been quarantined and the effect of businesses. My question is, I have a question. I had a point that I wanted to make, but I just can't quite do it at this moment. So I'm going to turn it back to the chair.
Representative McDonald, you have another member with a question, so think about your point and it might come back to you, and I will come back to you. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the bill's author. I just heard it was stated one of the things we're trying very hard to do is protect the employment of the frontline workers and our essential workers. How do you think this is going to affect protecting our employers, and how do they recover? Because what we're trying to do with this bill, I believe, is make sure that the frontline worker is receiving compensation while they are dealing with the effects of COVID. How does this bill help or harm businesses that are doing the exact same thing? Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Raleigh, thank you again for that question. I think this bill, what it does, you're gonna garner up a bunch of goodwill and loyalty from your employees because you're taking care of them. That's the one thing that I think you can, employers can count on that. The other piece is that you've had the employees that have been working to help sustain the employer because they provided labor, they provided a service that is providing revenue for that business. So I think, this is more of a, this is the employer now taking care of the employee after the employee has done what they can and been able to help to stay there and work through this pandemic and be on the front lines and be in kind of harm's way for the exposure to the virus every day. And I see this is nothing less than just taking care of those workers and acknowledging that.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one might be a bridge too far question, Representative Frazier. So what happens to a business that goes under because of the situation that they're in? And we've had lots of them here in Minnesota that have gone out of business. With a 2-year look back, once a business closes, do you believe that this bill would pierce the corporate veil and do a look back for 2 years on these on back pay? Or how do we envision an employer who's no longer in business being able to make good without violating this law?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Again, I could have gave you that question, so I appreciate it. Yeah, and it's just, so if you've got a situation where the business is no longer, if they dissolve and they're no longer there, they're not going to have any employees. For the way the statute is written, if you're no longer employed, you're not eligible for this.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I need to think a lot harder on that one. So I very, very much appreciate the answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald, did it come to you? Or?
Yes, it did.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, between my hyperbole and forgetting my question. So Representative Frazier, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you heard of employees that have been not been taken care of by their employers? You know, between the federal government and our state, we've been doing many, many things to take care of our employees that have contracted the COVID or have been home with their families. So just wondering if you have had personal stories or in having your bill drafted and communicating, have you heard from employees that simply their employers were not taking care of them, nor did the state or the federal government with their programs?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Representative McDonald, yes, there were employees that have, workers that have shared that. There were some that testified during the initial hearing, specifically to that, how their employers had not stepped up to the moment in taking care of them. And that is the specific reason that this bill is here. In fact, some of our healthcare workers that are there on the front lines day in, day out, and still there on the front lines day in, day out, were some of the folks that fell within this gap where they were not being taken care of by their employer, unfortunately.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the author, Mr. Frazier. Representative Frazier, is there going to be any impact on, if this bill passes, will there be any impact on our local governments, and will there be any increases in cost or property taxes for our local municipalities, our local governments?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Ackland, and Representative Detmer. Again, thank you for that question. I feel like you got my notes right here. So to that question, with the new act, actually that's going to go in effect pretty soon here, I'm assuming, they have allowed for local governments, county governments, to actually have access as well to the dollar-for-dollar tax write-off. So they'll get that money back if they're implementing these FFCRA programs. So no, it should not have an impact in that way in terms of raising property taxes.
Representative Depper.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Frazier, we'll make sure we send you our questions ahead of time, and it might speed things up.
I'm all about efficiency.
Any other member questions? Representative Frazier, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think in this time when our healthcare workers, especially, and not just our nurses and doctors, but the folks that the pharmacists and the technicians and the people that janitorial work folks all have been done heroic works in this pandemic, and they need to be identified and taken care of going forward. So any final comments, Representative Frazier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, thank you all for the really good questions. I think it poses for good conversation. I think that is the beauty of this process, being able to discuss these things, vet these bills. But for this building particularly, we've had our frontline workers that have been on the line since day one of this pandemic. And we just want to do the right thing and take care of them. Let them know that they really are essential workers and that we're going to stand by them. And we'll go back and make sure we've taken care of them if we didn't in the beginning, and we're going to be with them through until we get through this pandemic. So I urge you all to vote yes on this.
I will renew my motion that House File 41, as amended, be referred to State Government Finance, to the State Government Finance Committee. Ms. Doyle, will you please take the roll?
Chair Eklund?
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang?
Yes.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer?
Detmer, nay.
Detmer, nay. Representative McDonald?
McDonald, no, nay.
McDonald, nay. Representative Berg?
Yes.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss?
Nay.
Bliss, no. Representative Edelson? Representative Edelson? Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin?
Aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Edelson? There are 7 ayes, 5 nays.
7 ayes and 5 nays, the motion passes and the bill's on its way to State Gov Finance. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Still want to call you Frederick.
It happens. Thank you all.
Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 984 from Representative Liz LeGuyard. I will move that House File 984 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. Liz LeGuyard, we have a DE1. Would you like to move? Would you like me to move the amendment, or do you want to describe it first?
You can move it, Mr. Chair.
I will move the adoption of the DE1 amendment to the amendment, Representative Liz LeGuyard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The DE amendment, it limits the bill to oil refineries. It gives contractors a choice as to where an apprenticeship program can be registered. It allows flexibility for contractors to have up to 15% on site that have not been trained in the registered apprenticeship. It provides enforcement by the Labor Standards Division instead. And it also requested, that was requested by the Department of Labor and Industry, and would also provide civil penalties and private lawsuits for enforcement.
Any questions on the DE1 amendment? All in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, aye. Say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Liz LeGuyard, please explain your bill as amended.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 984 is a bill that speaks to some of the very reasons that I ran for office. It is about putting our best foot forward as a state and demonstrating that we take serious the safety of workers in our communities. This isn't some sort of union versus non-union. Many of you know me and know that my heart is with labor. So when this issue was brought before me and a representative from labor looks me in the eye and he says, Dave, this isn't union versus non-union. This is about the safety of workers. At that very moment, I knew how serious this bill was and it needed to be addressed. Today, you're going to hear from testifiers that follow me that the safety of the men and women in this state is at risk, and every single one of us should be troubled by this. House File 984 is a straightforward bill that is meant to protect safety of workers in hazardous facilities and the surrounding communities. With the Delete All Amendment, this bill has been narrowed to only impact oil refineries, which we all know are critical to fueling our homes, it fuels our economy, and is an essential part of our daily lives. But they are dangerous environments to work in, and we owe it to the men and women who work in these facilities to ensure that there's protection each and every day they go to work. This bill by no means is going to ensure that nothing bad ever happens again.
but it is going to strengthen the standards and will help ensure that oversight and proper training is given to workers. I spoke with a company official of one of these refineries recently, and they told me that this bill wouldn't do anything to fix the strike that is going on at one of their facilities. And I got to tell you, this really struck me odd, because all the conversations I had with all the different people, not one individual ever mentioned the word strike. This bill isn't about fixing a strike or interfering with private sector, not at all. This is about doing what's right by workers. This bill doesn't tell a refinery what contractor they have to hire. It simply states that they must work with contractors that have committed to training and oversight of their employees that best position them to be safe. It also doesn't demand that a contractor be a union contractor. There are plenty of non-union operations that have apprenticeship programs that adhere to the training and oversight that comes along with such a program. When I came here, I wanted to stand up for many things, but four in particular: workers, community, business, and those who couldn't stand up for themselves. I'm proud to be here today to be supporting this bill. Members, my heart is pure. We have a problem, and it's a serious one. You're going to hear from individuals who have been working in these facilities, and I believe that when you hear their stories, you're going to understand why they're passionate, I'm passionate, to fix this problem that is before us. I truly believe that this bill gives us an opportunity, not as Democrat, as Republican, union, or non-union. It's about what's doing right. It's that simple. With me today, I have several testifiers, but with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like Brendan Cummins to go through the bill from a technical aspect. And then after that, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like others to share their experience.
Thank you, Representative Liz Legarde. We'll go to testifiers, and I'll read off the first three. Brendan Cummings, Minnesota Pipe Trades, will be up first. Commissioner Nicole Lissenbach from Minnesota Department of Labor Industry, and then our old friend Chair Mahoney will be up third, and then I'll name the next three after that. Mr. Cummings from Minnesota Pipe Trades, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brendan Cummins, attorney for the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association. Testifying in support of the bill, I'll walk through its technical requirements. This bill would require contractors working at oil refineries to use a skilled workforce trained in registered apprenticeship programs. Section one of the bill is about enforcement. It would allow the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to issue compliance orders, which is the same tool that is already used to enforce other workplace laws. Section 2, subdivision 1 of the bill contains the definitions. The definition of contractor makes clear that this bill would apply to skilled work in construction, alteration, demolition, repair, maintenance, or hazardous material handling. The definition of contractor also applies to any level of subcontractors, but it does not include employees of the owner or operator of the oil refinery. Definition of registered apprenticeship program allows for the use of any apprenticeship program that is registered in one of three ways: with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, with the Federal Department of Labor, or with another state apprenticeship agency recognized by the federal government. This definition allows choice on where to register, but no matter which registration agency a program chooses, registered apprenticeship is subject to high standards of safety and training under the applicable federal regulations cited in the bill. The definition of skilled and trained workforce means that a minimum of 85% of each contractor's workforce on site, each contractor's workers on site, are either registered apprentices, graduates of registered apprenticeship programs, or who have completed the classroom training and work hours that would be needed to graduate from a registered apprenticeship program. The 85% minimum builds in a measure of flexibility to accommodate contractor business needs by allowing for an exemption for up to 15% of the contractor's workforce. Subdivision 2 requires each contractor to use a skilled and trained workforce when performing covered work at the site of an oil refinery. I've already explained the definition of what work is covered and skilled and trained workforce. And what this subdivision does is makes clear that the skilled and trained workforce must be used at the site of the oil refinery. Subdivision 3 establishes a civil penalty for violations similar to other civil penalties enforced by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. And Subdivision 4 authorizes lawsuits against violators similar to other workplace laws. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Please stick around if there's questions. Next up, Deputy Commissioner Listenbach. Commissioner, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I am pleased to testify on behalf of the administration in support of House File 984, as amended. The requirements in the bill for a skilled and trained workforce in the construction and maintenance of oil refineries will ensure workers have access to the skill development and training needed to perform the work safely. There are more than 10,000 registered apprentices actively training in various occupations today in Minnesota. Around 90% are in the construction sector. Registered apprenticeship is a time-tested employment-based training model that combines structured on-the-job learning with required related technical instruction. To be registered with the department, programs must deliver experienced journey worker supervision to guide apprenticeship work, a minimum number of hours of related technical instruction per year, and a minimum number of hours of safety instruction during the apprenticeship term. These minimum requirements and others ensure high quality training delivery and effective knowledge transfer with an emphasis on safety as one of the core components. Well-trained workers can improve workplace safety. We see that firsthand here at the department. This is good for workers, good for employers, and good for Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to share the support for this legislation.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next up is our old friend, Tim Mahoney. He retired as chair, so that's why I identified him as chair. Mr. Mahoney, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I could just introduce myself by my title, because apparently I'm able to use that title for the rest of my life, which is the Honorable State Representative Tim Mahoney, retired. The last time I tried to use that honorable piece, my union brothers and sisters started hooting and hollering, and one of them threw something. So there's always respect. Members, thank you for listening to me today. I do want to inform you of two things. There is life after the legislature. Retirement has been very, very good to me, and it'll get even better once the travel restrictions are lifted. And no, I am not a paid lobbyist. I am just a private citizen that thinks this is a good bill. I got a couple of text messages from friends that said, oh, you went over to the dark side. So with that said, members, I'm here to offer my support for this bill. House File 984, it's a very good bill. I spent three quarters of my time at the legislature working on workplace safety and serving on the Work Comp Advisory Council and championing OSHA rules, regulations, the inspections, and the penalties. The other place I put tremendous energy is job training. I can't tell you how good my heart feels when I know that the state has invested, although the state doesn't invest in most of the construction industry's training, someone has gotten a living wage job and can take care of their family and their bills. This bill addresses both. And in an oil refinery, they are both so critical. Oil refineries are one of the most dangerous places to earn a living. From saws that can cut off your fingers in an instant, to live hydrogen units that can explode from one wrong spark. And I just want you to know, through good luck, good work, safety protocol, we've never had an explosion of hydrogen in this state, ever. And I hope we never do. In between, you can be injured from vapors, from asbestos, from loud noises, from falls, slips, tripping hazards, burns, and my favorite, steel in the eye. There are many other hazards also that I don't want to take up the time of the committee to mention, but you get the idea. In my apprenticeship training, we had 2 days in the classroom and 3 days in the shop. My instructor, Mr. Hugh Jelly, spent time telling us every day, showing us every day the ways to be safe and how to not get hurt. We would talk about how to work safely and what our rights were to have a safe work environment to be in. Any job employers want well-trained employees. That really is a key to having a very successful business, or one of the main keys to having a very successful business. A good apprenticeship program teaches not only safety, but how to be a productive worker the first day on the job. In the trade that employed me for 30 years, we learned many things from threading pipe to installing pipe, to how to build pipe supports, how to install steel, copper, plastic, you name it, we learned how to install it. We learned how to read blueprints and how to draw blueprints, how to use tools of the trade, everything from basic pipe wrenches to magnetic drills, to tap and die sets, plasma arcs, oxyacetylene torches, how to lift heavy equipment with cranes, how to install and fix HVAC systems, how to install and fix ammonia systems and high pressure piping. Apprentice training makes you a smarter, safer, and more productive worker. In today's markets, where the price is so important, smarter, safer, more productive employees is what the construction contractors and their customers are asking for. We have around 10,000 apprentices in Minnesota training programs in many different industries. We have the best or one of the best run and highest standard programs in the nation. But this bill, which I really appreciate, this bill recognizes that there are both federal and state programs across the nation, and it is agnostic about which and where. It only wants you to have graduated from or accumulated the equivalent of apprenticeship training programs. Mr. Chair, this is a good bill. And as I used to say, it's a good bill, you should vote for it. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mahoney, I appreciate your time. The next four people on the list, so I thought we had more, are Matthew Foss, Kevin Chapdelaine, Dean Mills, and Adam Hansen. Mr. Foss, Matthew Foss, fire mechanic and rescue lieutenant. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and committee members. My name is Matt Foss. I live with my wife and two kids. I grew up in West St. Paul, Minnesota. I've worked at the St. Paul Park Refinery for 22 years as a firefighter and fire mechanic. I love my job, but I and many others, co-workers, are worried that the decline of safety and training standards at this facility. I'm here today to talk to you about some troubling issues I have witnessed and to advocate for improved safety and training standards in the bill before you today that will make sure refineries like St. Paul Park are safer places to work for employees and the people who live, work, or go to school nearby. Let me be clear, a refinery is a very dangerous place to work. A small mistake can have catastrophic consequences. Using the wrong equipment to clean a tank, failure to use the proper PPE, personal protective equipment, incorrectly handling of chemicals such as hydrofluoric acid. These are mistakes that not only put refinery workers at risk, but they can also expose neighboring communities to a disaster. I have seen firsthand what happens when high road contractors are replaced with contractors who do not train their employees to apprenticeship standards. And that's a risk that doesn't need to exist. I've also seen untrained subcontractors that don't know how to use Minnesota fire hydrants, a critical infrastructure and safety for the plant. I've seen untrained subcontractors use life critical safety equipment, such as self-contained breathing apparatuses, incorrectly. That puts myself, a firefighter, my coworkers, and the community at risk. In conclusion, these guys don't know what they don't know. And that is a dangerous thing in a place like St. Paul Park Refinery. With apprenticeship level training, these folks will be able to read a situation and be trained to ask the right questions before they do a dangerous job in the plant. My job is to make the refinery safe for all employees and the community around us. This bill would make it easier for me to do that. Thank you for your time. I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Foss. Next up, Kevin Chapdelaine, Newport City Council member. Counselor, if I got your name wrong, I apologize. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and committee members. You did a fine job, Chair. That's exactly the way it's pronounced. For the record, my name is Kevin Chapdelaine. I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of House File 984 today. I am a city council member in Newport and a retired pipefitter from St. Paul Pipefitters Local 455. During my 38 years of working as a pipefitter, I've had the privilege of working in both the Flint Hills and the St. Paul Park Marathon Oil refineries. My wife, Wendy, and I have also lived about six blocks from the St. Paul Park Marathon refinery now for over 28 years. Having served a five-year apprenticeship myself, as well as having trained many apprentices during my career, including one of today's previous testifiers, I'm a big believer in the value of registered apprenticeship programs to train young men and women to be safe and productive workers. I have worked in these facilities and am familiar with their operation. I believe these are not the places for poorly or untrained individuals to work. The risks are just too high. In Minnesota, we have some of the finest registered apprenticeship programs in the country, and in my opinion, we should be very proud of that. Minnesota has become the gold standard for safety and high-quality training. As you may imagine, living near an oil refinery comes with a level of concern that does not exist in other types of industry. This year, that level of concern has escalated dramatically. I have heard from many of my constituents over the past few months, and the increased angst from my community is unanimous. As a city council member, my other main concern is for the members of Newport's fire department. It's one thing for a paid on-call firefighter to fight a residential fire. It's something entirely different to ask them to address a large refinery fire. For these reasons and more, I believe it is critical to have safe industrial facilities, both for the workers and the surrounding communities. I support House File 984, which will help ensure that level of safety, and I respectfully ask that you do as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. Next up, Dean Mills, Director of Training and Apprenticeship, Laborers Training Center. Mr. Mills, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and committee members. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Dean Mills. I'm the Director of Training and Apprenticeship for the Laborers Training Center. Since our program began back in 1999, we had nearly 4,000 labor apprentices that have graduated from our program. We average around 150,000 annual training hours per year for apprentices and journey workers. Our team is very proud to be the largest apprenticeship program in the state. We have been learning a resource for skilled construction community for decades. We are dedicated to sharing our knowledge and space for generations to come. I had the privilege of spending 12 years of my career working in a refinery in St. Paul Park. The safety standards that exist on industrial work sites today are so much further along than when I started back in 1987. One of the most important benefits of apprenticeship training is proper use of PPE, such as eye, hearing, respiratory protection, and job safety analysis. Registered apprenticeship programs lead to safer workforce and refineries. As an apprentice, you'll learn more how to pour concrete, build scaffolding, deal with chemicals, work in confined spaces, perform fire watch duties, and so much more. When you're inside the gate of the refinery, every moment is a potential hazard. Every worker must be skilled and aware to prevent mistakes and injuries and/or deaths. Apprentices learn from technical theory, skills practices to equip workers with broad ranges of skills, knowledge, and hands-on experience to safely work in refineries. We continually update our programs to be consistent with industry and technological advances. This is another reason why union trade workers are the safest, most current, and qualified professionals in refinery jobs. This bill will keep refinery workers and the community safe by ensuring the highest safety standards in the skill force. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Adam Hansen, Director of Public Government and Public Affairs, Associated Builders and Contractors, Minnesota and North Dakota. And please be quick, Mr. Hansen, we do need to vote on this bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Our contractors are commercial and industrial builders, and the men and women that they employ are part of the 75% of the construction industry that choose to be merit shop craft professionals rather than be in a union. Several of our members build, maintain, and repair Minnesota's refineries covered under the sweeping legislation. Our members have customized in-house safety programs, craft training programs, and more, even though they're not registered with the state. They take pride in their work and even more so their safety record for each and every employee that they have. I'm testifying today, however, in opposition to the bill, which for the first time in Minnesota mandate registered apprenticeship programs on wholly private construction projects. This bill will have a discriminatory impact against qualified local contractors and the qualified local men and women they employ. If you're part of the 75% of Minnesota's construction workforce who aren't in a union, the odds are you're not in a registered apprenticeship program and would therefore be essentially prohibited right off the bat from working on projects under the bill. Now, the absence of a registered apprenticeship program has nothing to do with a contractor's ability to perform work, the work product, or the ability to perform that work safely. Building trades advocates will claim that this issue is about safety and is about quality. But if that were truly the case, why would their union agents and recruiters spend so much time and energy trying to recruit our members and their workers into their ranks? I'm holding a solicitation document from a particular electrical workers union, for example, that's been handed about to several of our members recently in hopes of them becoming signatory contractors. Now that speaks more to my members' craftsmanship, safety records, and ability to perform work than any of the testimony we've heard today, in my opinion. My favorite part of their solicitation request is the union marketing its registered apprenticeship program as a way to lower labor costs. Let that sink in. What we didn't hear from the bill's advocates today are the municipalities in Pennsylvania and Michigan, for example, that recently repealed their apprenticeship mandates on public construction because their ordinances disproportionately kept out small and minority-owned companies who largely don't participate in these registered programs. The same discriminatory effect will happen if this bill becomes law. Enrollment in Minnesota's registered apprenticeship programs by women and people of color, especially among the trades affected by this bill, is also remarkably low. A few snapshots or a few examples from DLI's most recent registered apprenticeship data can shed some light on this. The Minneapolis and St. Paul Pipefitters Union has 491 total apprentices. Less than 20 of them are women and only 22 apprentices of color. How about the operating engineers? 295 total apprentices. Less than 20 of them are apprentices of color. The numbers for the Southeast Minnesota Plumbing and Steam Union program? Not so good either. 74 apprentices, only two women, and only two apprentices of color. The numbers for the state registered apprenticeship programs for the sprinkler fitters, laborers, elevator union, and others have similar patterns. This bill also encourages and enables out-of-state contractors and out-of-state workers to come into this state while keeping Minnesota contractors and their craft professionals shut out. On a recent stakeholders call for this bill, the president of a certain building trades union described his members as roving bands of workers who travel the country doing seasonal work at refineries. This legislation would only exacerbate that problem here. While we're glad to see the DE amendment fix the incredibly broad swath of projects that the original bill covered, limiting the apprenticeship mandate just to oil refineries still doesn't fix the discriminatory nature and impact of the mandate itself. Associated Builders and Contractors thinks that all qualified, licensed contractors and their craft professionals should be allowed to bid and work here, not just those with political connections, and especially when out-of-state contractors are given preference over local construction workers, as is the case with this bill. I would strongly encourage this committee to reconsider this new, unprecedented and discriminatory mandate and vote no on House File 984.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Members, we have questions and comments. We have about 6 minutes left. We have a choice on voting on a bill at 4:30 or recessing and coming back at 6:30 to finish business. Member questions. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hello to Representative Mahoney, if he's still watching. It was good to see him. Question regarding the bill. I'm not convinced that those who have been in the industry working, let's say, as welders at the refinery for 25 or 30 years who are skilled and have been trained probably by experts for them within the industry would need to go back to an apprentice program to be retrained for safety issues. Now, I certainly recognize and understand the union, the trade unions. Our local unions have great training facilities. I visited several of them. I have some good friends that work them and are in the training. And they do specify safety. And for that, most people, I am thankful as well. But I'm not convinced that this bill is necessary for those skilled labor who has that expertise would have to go back to get an apprentice program to be trained to what they've been doing for 25 years. So curious as to what the author, what say you?
Representative Lizegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. What is your specific question? Is your question referencing somebody that works in the facility for 25 years and they have to go get an apprenticeship because the steel workers and the Teamsters that are currently in there, the employees inside, they're not, it's not for them. It's outside contracting.
Representative McDonald.
Well, then, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Listergaard, then those outside contracting that have that expertise that have been working in the industry and perhaps even in the refinery for years, why would that be necessary for them to go back to be retrained when they've already had the expertise in that industry and that particular skill?
Representative Listergaard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. This is about setting a standard in oversight. There are a lot of individuals that through hard work and long term, they have the skill set. But when you go into a trade, there's documentation, there's progress being made, you have oversight each and every day. That's what this is. This is about ensuring that there is oversight and there is proper training. There's nothing to say that somebody that worked somewhere else for 25 years, that they can't go in and join the apprenticeship and then be that up just because they have all that experience. It happens all the time.
Representative McDonald.
Well, I just, many folks just don't think that's necessary, Representative Listergaard. If you have the expertise and training for the last 30 years in a particular career, be it pipe fitting or welding or hazardous material or demolition, you don't need to go back to an apprentice program to be retrained. So I think I've heard from several folks that just in that particular case is not necessary. Perhaps for a new worker, perhaps that's the case, but that's certainly not the case for those who trade labors who already do subcontracting work for this industry.
Is that a final comment, Representative McDonald, or was that a question?
Okay, yes, that's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Representative Listergaard, there's a couple of different areas within the bill that don't offer the apprenticeship program. I've been notified by hazardous material demolitions and I think hazardous waste removal. So those are no apprenticeship programs currently. What about those particular careers then, if your bill doesn't address that?
Representative Lizegard.
Mr. Chair, if I could go to Brendan Cummins for that response to Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative McDonald, all of the types of work that are listed in the bill are apprenticeable trades and have registered apprenticeship programs. Hazardous material handling is something that the laborers program trains for. For example, Mr. Mills testified already today. There may be other trades that train in that as well. Demolition is trained by the laborers. Mr. Mills testified today. Again, that's his program. Each one of those items has a registered apprenticeship program, and the definition of the work was drafted so that it would cover the apprenticeable trades, not the employees of the facility.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarifying that. Just lastly, then, because I know we're on a strict time, Representative Listergaard, I appreciate your passion and your heart is into this. That's awesome, and it's evident. I'm sorry I can't support this bill at the time, but just to note, two of your testifiers did say they had the honor of working at these two refineries. No, never did they say that it's unsafe and this bill has to be. They had the honor of working there, and that should tell you enough that these industries are care for the safety and well-being of all their employees and families. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member questions? I've got one comment before I let Representative Lizegard close. I had the honor of working at a paper mill, and I was honored to know that the apprentices and pipe fitters and skilled tradespeople that came in there had the proper safety and training to make sure that the outages were done correctly and positively. And I think this is just a bill that needs to be voted for as we're going forward, because it's going to further ensure the safety of the workers and the employees down the road. Closing comments, Representative Lizegard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, and to everyone that testified and shared your story. I will address Mr. Hansen. For the last 2 months of me working on this, not one individual ripped on non-union companies. And what I heard that gentleman do was rip on labor for some reason. This isn't non-union versus union. This is about ensuring that employees, both inside the facility and contractors coming in, have the right to go home safe to their families and their communities. That's what this bill is. Has nothing to do versus union or non-union. So that comment to me and that demeanor of his presentation was totally out of line and disrespectful for the safety of the people in and outside that facility. So with that, thank you, members, and I would hope that you would support this bill.
I will renew my motion that House File 94, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Nay.
Detmer, no. Representative McDonald.
No.
McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 8 ayes, 5 noes.
8 ayes and 5 noes. The bill is on its way to Judiciary. Members and staff, our next meeting is Friday, March 12th, 2021. We are adjourned.